Hey, this is WTOP's Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by, why don't you just each take turns, saying your name and your title.
I'm Dr. Tim Westcott, director of the George S. Robb Center for the Study of the Great War at Park University.
I'm Joshua Weston. I'm the associate director of military research.
Ashlyn Weber, associate director of research and initiatives.
We're talking about the new 30-minute documentary, More Than a Medal, World War One. Give us the basic premise of it before we start.
It's a documentary dealing with a systematic review, Valor Medals review, of African-American, Asian-American, Hispanic-American, Jewish-American, and Native American World War One service members that may have been denied the Medal of Honor due to race or religious discrimination. So it takes us through our research process, our engagement with two daughters still living of the 214 service members we've identified.
Wow. So, I want to unpack that in a second, but we should tell everybody that there's going to be a screening of it at the National Museum of the U.S. Army on Tuesday, October 18th, and another one at the U.S. Navy Memorial on Thursday, October 20th. All right, tell us about those events. Is it free, open to the public? Do we have to register ahead of time? How does it work?
Yeah, so it's free to the public, both events. All you have to do is register through a link on our social media pages, Park University, P-A-R-K. And we look forward to seeing everybody there.
Awesome. Well, let's go back into more of the content. How big of a problem has this been over the years? I mean, this goes dates all the way back to World War One, so we're talking literally a century ago of folks of color being potentially denied Medal of Honors here. How big of a problem has this been throughout military history?
Well, in terms of a systematic review, this is the first one for World War One and probably the last one. This is also the largest systematic review ever performed. So we've seen reviews of World War II, Korean conflict, and Vietnam service members, but usually only one or two groups. African Americans and Native Americans are the most frequent. So this being the largest with five groups, we've never seen this before, and neither has the Department of Defense. So this was a problem that the United States Congress, as well as us on our team at Park University and the Robb Center, thought was a valuable thing to undertake.
Absolutely. So after these reviews take place, are any Medal of Honors, rewarded after the fact, even posthumously, based on the findings? They say, oh, wow, someone was very heroic, but denied based on their race, religion, whatever. But now in hindsight, we're going to try to, write it and give them a medal.
There have been 121 Medal of Honor recipients from World War One. Only seven of that 121 are service members from one of those five demographic groups that we mentioned. Three of those seven have been more recently, and by that I mean within the last couple of decades, two of those being African-American and one being a Jewish-American. So, and those three definitely were posthumously awarded in that sense. So yes, it can happen. And it happens, from World War II and, some other more recent conflicts that it can occur. So we're, doing the research, which Josh can definitely talk about, and hopefully we can provide some of those service members, the honor that they deserve for their acts of valor.
Awesome. Let's go into some of the personal stories of some of the heroic acts of valor that you're mentioning. And particularly in the 30-minute doc, More Than a Medal. Tell us some of the individual, soldiers or otherwise that maybe you highlight that should have been honored in the first place.
First and foremost, I want to kind of preface that we don't refer to our guys as soldiers, because we have Marines
Sure.
Well, so we just
service members.
Yes, sir. One of the tales that, well, I wouldn't even call it a tale. One of the acts of valor that I think is really important to know is Private Key, Sing Lao Key. He was part of the 77th Division, and he was stationed at Mount Notre Dame. It was actually during the Wazain Offensive. He single-handedly operated the communications post on top of the mountain as the 77th Division was completing the organization of their line during the Wazain Offensive. In the area that they were specifically at, the German 7th Army was barraging the 77th Division day in, day out, high explosives, mustard gas, so on and so forth. Sing Ki ended up being the only person on Mount Notre Dame and single-handedly operated the command station, meaning that he was communicating with the headquarters in the rear of the line and relaying the message from headquarters to the front line, helping to get everything organized. Had he not been there, the 77th Division would have likely been overran by the Germans, given that they were continuously poking and prodding the lines day in, day out, along with all the artillery and the planes that were flying overhead, dropping bombs and grenades on them. So, you know, I just couldn't imagine being in his position, because especially since he was on top of a mountain, the fact is that the artillery had a much easier time hitting that mountain than it did the 77th Division's front lines. Again, he was just constantly being hit by high explosives and mustard gas, and that made no difference to him and his personal safety, because he cared more about the operation and the Allied forces' success than he did his own self.
Wow.
So let me add possibly one that's a little bit more closer to your viewing audience.
Sure, yeah.
And I'll go back maybe a moment to clarify the service member. Josh is a United States Army vet, and I'm a Marine Corps vet. So we always play off on that whole component. So,
well, thank you for your service, even though I know that has become a bit of a cliche line, but seriously, thank you so much.
So there was an African-American service member, named William A. Butler from Salisbury, Maryland, serves in the 93rd Division, better known as the Harlem Hellfighters. And in September of 1918, he's engaged in a major battle in which he ultimately will be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. But what makes his case interesting in our connectivity to his case is that the Robb Center is named after a 1912 graduate of what was then Park College. He was a white officer in the 93rd Division, or the Harlem Hellfighters. Robb is a Medal of Honor recipient for his actions in September of 1918. And Robb's Medal of Honor nomination document has Robb's nomination on the top part of that piece of paper. And literally on the same piece of paper right below Robb's is the Medal of Honor nomination for William A. Butler. Robb receives the Medal of Honor, and Butler's is downgraded to a Distinguished Service Cross. And literally almost for the same actions, and they're on the same form when they were submitted to the United States Army. And
so there could be really no other reason except for prejudice.
Race might be a very strong case right there. Yes.
Yeah.
But that's one of those local for your viewers. And because there's a number of them, out of the 214 that are, you know, from your viewing area. So
yeah. And just real quick, could you say could you both spell the names of the two gentlemen that you mentioned?
Yeah, so the first one is William Alexander Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R. And the second one is Singlau Ke, S-I-N-G-L-A-U-K-E-E. And just to follow up, Butler receives the Distinguished Service Cross, the Croix de Guerre with Bronze Palm, and the Purple Heart. Ke receives Distinguished Service Cross, Croix de Guerre with Bronze Star, and Purple Heart as well.
But not the Medal of Honor.
Correct.
Man. All right. So, you know, we're highlighting these stories of, you know, quote, hidden figures that should have gotten honored and that you hope would get honored. But what exactly, you know, tangibly, what sort of a timeline is there for, you know, submission, nomination, even reviewing, you know, in order for someone to receive a Medal of Honor? Like, I'm sure it's a multi-year process.
We received authorization within the National Defense Authorization Act of 2019. For a 5-year period of time. We currently, again, back to COVID, have a 1-year extension to complete our research, which then would take us to late December 2025. And then once we do our narratives, and once we believe a nomination packet is prepared, then we send it to the United States Army, which would cover the Army and the Army Air Corps, or the United States Navy for the Marines, the Navy, and then the Navy Air Corps. And then they have their period of time, which can take up to 2 years for each branch of the service to review and then get it through the Department of Defense and onto the President's desk.
Is the hope that, you know, after screening such a movie that maybe they will receive them? I mean, I kind of asked that earlier, but I mean, as specific to these two cases, like what are the chances that might happen? Or I mean, is that an aim for you, or is it more like let's not let this happen more in the future, or is it all of it really?
I think personally, I mean, the documentary itself, it's a good it's a good way to raise awareness of, you know, past prejudices everybody is obviously already aware of. To me personally, I'm not sure if it's going to make a difference to the DOD or not. I'm hoping it puts a little bit of pressure on them, but regardless, the research that I specifically in my area do is very objective. It's very matter of fact. And a lot of the evidence that I present to the DOD is pretty much undeniable that these service members do deserve the Medal of Honor. I think that at least my goal is to raise the understanding of past prejudice, especially during the early 1900s. I mean, the war seems like it was so long ago, but it's everything about it is still affecting us to this day. I personally think that what we're doing, and I truly do hope, is that we create kind of a through raising the awareness, we kind of set a standard of, you know, no more. Like, we want to be treated as equals regardless of, you know, race, religion, sex, sexual orientation, so on and so forth. And I think that this is just one of many things that needs to happen in order to set the precedence that we are moving forward in history in a more positive and progressive way than just allowing past injustices to just go by and completely ignored.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I'm all about the mission here of it. It's thank you for what you all are doing by shining a light on this. Well, tell me about we've gone a lot into you know, the subject matter, but tell me about the filmmaking process. itself. You know, it's a 30-minute doc, but you know, our listeners need to realize. I mean, that might sound like a, you know, quote unquote short film, but it is a task and a half. It's a miracle every time you finish even a 30-minute film. It's truly just as hard as a feature in some ways from experience. So, explain sort of how, you know, how long it took you to put together. You know, pre-production, production, post. Give me some of the details on the actual filmmaking process.
Well, Lame Deer Films gets a lot of the attention on this one. They're the directors and producers of this program. But I can tell you it was about 5 days in 90-degree heat, middle of July, in our office in Parkville, Missouri. And most of it was Josh, Tim, and myself just sitting down doing our jobs. And if they found it interesting, they put a camera on us. So a lot of it is dealing with primary evidence, documentation, photographs, cartographic records, moving picture reels, and they just kind of walked around and asked questions, and it's a lot of fun for us because we love talking about what we do. But I can imagine they left Kansas City feeling a little overwhelmed with the implications of some of the decisions we have to make. So we're extremely proud of the film so far, and we hope that people enjoy it. But you know, hopefully everybody just keeps in mind this is a multi-year process. And we're only halfway through. So the hundreds, if not thousands, of documents we already hold in-house is just gonna become more overwhelming over time. So hopefully everybody gets a little bit of a glimpse, but there's usually many more man hours that go into it.
Oh, definitely. Go ahead.
I think what we sometimes miss, and I think we even sort of look back now, is that the premise for the documentary came out with some preliminary conversations pre-COVID, and then COVID hit.
Right.
And people weren't allowed, were traveling. You know, our campus was closed down for about a year. So we had to deal with trying to produce a documentary basically virtually.
Right.
In some sense, which... Lame Deer Films, Alex and Clark, you know, they were absolutely wonderful in, you know, their schedules, our schedules, trying to get them documents. And then when they get here, they deal with us, but they also then were able to have some wonderful experiences and interviews with our senior administrators, but then with the Veterans of Foreign Wars, who has their national headquarters here in Kansas City, who was also one of our major financial sponsors. And then they spent a good day at the National World War I Museum and Memorial, which is also here in Kansas City, and were able to shoot some phenomenal footage and interview Chief Executive Officer and the President. So it was, yes, you know, 5 days, you know, on site, but it was the two and a half years previous to that. And then in part of our current situation also deals with the National Archives Record Center in St. Louis. You know, they've been, you know, archives were closed due to COVID.
Right.
So they're just sort of just now getting back into, you know, full operations. And so we're still waiting for service member records from submissions of two and a half, 3 years ago.
Wow. Yeah. And thank you. That's such an important part. Thanks for mentioning the pandemic documentary filmmaking, the pandemic element of it. Cause that, you know, hats off to you all for doing that. I remember at the beginning of this whole, you know, the pandemic, we did a Zoom interview with Ken Burns, and he was like in the attic of a barn putting together something together. Like it can be done, but I'm sure, you know, it's definitely an interesting experience. Well, what I think is really cool. Say again.
I'm sorry. This is Brad. I think, Tim or Ashlyn or someone can maybe mention, it wasn't just the 5 days in Kansas City, but the filmmakers also had to go to the families that are featured in the film as well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about. I wanted to ask about some of the family members you mentioned, because, you know, even in the 2-minute trailer, there's Some really, it's cool that, you know, you're interviewing, you know, it looks like family members in their house, and they're like showing, they're physically showing like almost like scrapbook images of, you know, of their relatives, their service members. And then, you know, and then from there you can cut into the archival footage that you found. So talk about the people you actually, you know, the living rooms you went and sat down in and interviewed people.
Emma Oskey Warner, whose father was Dr. Jones. Now, she is a daughter, so she is one of the four living daughters of the service members that we have connected to. And the other one then was Beatrice Key, the daughter of Singan Key, who we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And Dr. Emma, as we basically refer to her, as has been absolutely wonderful. She, like you say, you can see the collection, you know, she has in her house. She's professor emeritus at Haverford College. So she's, you know, she knows how to maintain records, which is wonderful. And then Beatrice Key, as you saw in the trailer, the wonderful exhibit of they've been able to maintain and frame. But yeah, Alex and Clark physically went to both locations. One's outside of Philadelphia, and then the Keys are in New York City. So, yeah, you know, from that point. So, yeah, it makes the documentary, in my opinion, more personal, because these are actually daughters. These are daughters that grew up with the actual World War One veteran. It's, you know, from that point, and they still maintain their family, you know, heirlooms and the collections, but also in what, as you see, we'll see in Dr. Emma, the personal stories. Her dad had her when he was 60. He was a famous doctor in the Washington, D.C. area and worked at Walter Reed and et cetera, as an African-American doctor. I mean, that's what's unique about, you know, some of these service members that we document, but I think, in my opinion, we also don't want to forget, and it goes back to your earlier point, Jason, of the ordinary private or private first class that could not read, could not write, spoke an entirely different language, either that being related to their Hispanic heritage or their Native American heritage. Or in our Jewish Americans, as Ashland could definitely attest to, a lot of our service members from the Jewish demographic group are from Eastern Europe. They had just literally arrived, you know, less than a decade ago, or maybe a little over a decade ago, into the United States. And here they are serving for a country they may not even be a citizen for. Native Americans were not citizens until 1924. Right. But you know, these Jewish Americans from Eastern Europe would speak Russian or some total different language. And being able to record that is what we find on a daily basis, phenomenal narratives that we can tell.
Awesome. Yeah, it's such, thank you so much for doing this movie. It's, you know, when you think of, at least maybe from personal experience, I I've always thought of the military as one of those things that, you know, transcends race. It's colorblind, you know, people from all different races and religions and backgrounds, economic statuses, they sign up, they go in and, you know, almost, you know, like a football team, but on a whole other level, life and death level, you know, they come together and it's a band of brothers and sisters now, where it doesn't matter what color you are. At least that's what we think. And then, you know, and then a lot of them came back to it, speak to how, you know, that was sort of, at least maybe it's a romanticized notion, maybe that it's apocryphal even, but you know, it's sort of the idea that we're all fighting together. And then, but then a lot of people come home to a country and they didn't have the right to vote in a lot of cases, or in this case, they had their valor dinged and demoted down where they didn't get the Medal of Honor, even though they're on the same sheet of paper as the other guy, just for their, you know, race. I don't know. I'm just thinking out loud. speak to that concept a little bit about how it can be, or maybe should be, a colorblind thing where we're all, you know, it's life or death and we all have each other's back.
Well, yeah, it definitely, that's definitely how the military is. Even within the same service branches, you know, we give each other, we joke with each other depending on what our MOS is. But even then, you know, if we're all in the Army, we have that loyalty towards one another. And then it expands further where, you know, even though I'm a soldier and Doc is a Marine, there's still that connection between the military, just fighting for one's country, shedding blood for one another. Back when these gentlemen were serving was a completely different world than what we live in now. You know, the Birth of a Nation came out 2 years prior to the entrance of the U.S. entering the war. There were race riots in Oklahoma, Tulsa, or Houston, places like that. And when these guys were arriving back home, it didn't matter what their service was. They were still getting lynched. I mean, not to be too straightforward, but that it was still happening despite what their service was to the country.
Right. The Red Summer was right off the heels of World War One.
Exactly. Yes. And again, you know, it was a totally different society than what we live in now, but you know, and that's why I think we're so dedicated to this project, is there's that aspect to what we're doing, is regardless of, you know, race, gender, so on and so forth. You know, these men served for the country, and we owe it to them to serve them back. You know, I always say valor never expires, and I stand by that. There's only one way that I personally can see to it that I at least did my part to get these men what they deserve, or, you know, and that's at least by trying to recognize what, you know, the struggles that they went through both over there and at home.
Awesome. Well said, well said. Valor never expires. Perfect place to leave it. Yeah, hard to believe, but Zoom is giving me the old go home warning. So we'll have to wrap it up here, I guess, sort of. We'll close it out here. Pretend I'm not even here, and like you're speaking directly to our listeners, you know, maybe they're, you know, stuck in traffic driving around the DMV and they hear this on WTOP. I don't know which one of you wants to take it, but, you know, just say, hey, everyone, come on out to the events on October 18th and October 20th, tell them why they should come on out.
The Rob Center team would love to see you on October 18th and October 20th in the Washington, D.C. area to watch More Than a Medal, a story about service members in World War One who were discriminated against due to their race or religion. We would love to see you there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for not only the film, but the ongoing, you know, the work you do at, you know, with the Rob Center. Thank you so much. Keep bringing these stories to light. Both from the past. See, I have this hunch that there is no past, present, or future. I really think that they all speak to each other. So when all of you highlight these past stories, I really think it affects our present and hopefully shapes a future where, you know, people are getting honored for their valor. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Jason.